Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, friends. It is such a joy and a privilege to spend another afternoon with you. And today is Halloween. That's a loaded statement, I know, right off the top. But you know what? One of the most Googled questions today, if you go into your internet search browser and you just put the word should, it will auto-populate, should Christian families participate in Halloween? And many families struggle with what to do. So I acknowledge out there listening, those of you driving, at work, at home, in the carpool line, we've got families all across the spectrum. Now, some families see this as an opportunity to meet and reach their neighbors. And some families participate in alternative activities like fall festivals or trunk or treat community events. And some families lock the door, turn off the porch light, and just hunker down until the trick or treaters have passed. Now, here's the thing. How your family makes the decision of what to do or what not to do is just as important, if not more important, as what decision your family makes. So we're going to talk about all things Halloween today, but really, this is a critical opportunity for you to take some self-reflection, to think about your family dialogue and conversation. You may have decided what to do or what not to do, but have you communicated that with your family very clearly? Is everyone on the same page? If someone asked your kid, if they appear, ask them, what are you doing or not doing? Could they give an answer? As parents, we really need to be thoughtful, intentional, and mostly prayerful as we guide our family in decision-making and tradition setting. Now, traditions create deeply ingrained sense of connection and emotion, and so it's an important honor that we have to steward as parents. So no matter what you decide to do or not do today, it is an opportunity. There is opportunity for your family, your friends, and your neighbors to see Christ in you as a desperately needed beacon of light and hope on a day of darkness. So let's dive in. Let's start at the beginning. What is Halloween anyway? How did it start? Let's just kind of start with where we came from. Now, some of you are going to know even more than I did, but I have to tell you, in doing some research and preparing to talk with you this afternoon, I learned a lot. Did you know that Halloween actually started as a three-day ancient festival started by Celtic people in Northern Europe? It was actually originally called Samhain, and it translates to summer's end. So it centered on appeasing the world of the gods. There was nothing Christian about the origin of this. People wore costumes to ward off ghosts, and they believed the boundaries between the living and the dead became blurred during this ritual. They also believed this blurred boundary made it easy for the druids, the Celtic priests, to make predictions about the futures. And they built bonfires, which we still see today, but those at the time were built to offer animal and crop sacrifices to Celtic deities. Now, fast forward to AD 43, and the Roman Empire had conquered the majority of Celtic territory. And over the next 400 years, we have this kind of odd mismatch of Roman festivals. One was called Feralia, remembering the dead. One was called Pomona, which was honoring the Roman goddess of fruit and trees. And they were combined with the traditional Celtic celebration. And in 609 AD, we're talking almost 600 years later, Pope Boniface IV declared a new celebration when he dedicated the Pantheon in Rome, and he called it All Hallows Day. That was to celebrate martyrs who sacrificed their lives for their Christian faith. Now, in the 8th century, Pope Gregory expanded that celebration to include not just martyrs, but also saints. So now we have All Saints Day, designated November 1st as the celebration date, leading to All Hallows Eve the night before. Now, I have a feeling there's some homeschooling families out there who could also tell you very, very well about the connection of Martin Luther and the Reformation to that as well. But by AD 1000, Christian influence had spread widely into Celtic lands, and the church declared November 2nd as All Souls Day. They were trying to replace a holiday with pagan roots. And where people used to dress up as animals, now they were dressing up as saints and angels and devils. You see the kind of modern influence emerging. Let's fast forward once again to American colonial times. And Halloween really did not exist because of the strict Puritan culture. But as European influence increased and mixed with indigenous tribes, harvest celebrations emerged. But you saw some of those similar elements still there. Ghost stories, telling fortunes, making mischief. But did you know it was actually the Irish potato famine, of all things, in the mid-18th century that ushered in an era of large-scale immigration and with it, celebration of Halloween? So borrowing from this European tradition, people would start dressing up, they would go door to door asking for money, and that became trick-or-treating. Young women also started divination practices, thinking they could somehow learn who their future husband was. And in the late 1800s, there was really a concerted movement in America to reject those pagan practices of Halloween and instead focus on community and family. Even if you look at newspaper headlines from the 20s and 30s, they were encouraging parents and families to reject the scary nature of Halloween. And by the 1920s, Halloween in America was not associated as a religious holiday, but it was seen more as a community celebration. But even then, teens were mischievous, and they were engaging in pranks and misconduct, and trick-or-treating was kind of revived as a way to entice those people to be kind as to those people who were passing out candy. And I think we've all seen movies depicting that those kinds of pranks. But today in America, did you know that we have a $12 billion holiday in Halloween? Last year, it was $10 billion, and $500 million of that will be spent on, are you ready for this, pet costumes. We're spending $500 million a year on our pet costumes. But that $12 billion is a per-person spending of $108 per person. That is unbelievable to me. Families spend more on Halloween festivities than any other holiday except for Christmas. And I thought this was interesting. According to a national survey from the National Retail Federation, about 76% of people say they're going to participate in some sort of Halloween activity this year. Now, the top ways that they're doing that are passing out candy, that's 68%, decorating their home a little over half are planning to dress up in a costume, about a third are going to a party, and 28% say they're going to take their children trick-or-treating. Now, dressing up when we go trick-or-treating has evolved from animals to ghosts to disguises. Actually, it went through that for a little bit because people were terrified of these dead spirits recognizing them. And now it's just seen as fun to scare your neighbors. So let's talk about Halloween costumes. For this year, the number one Halloween costume for kids is Spider-Man. That's 2.6 million children planning that. Second comes in as their favorite princess, around 1.6 million as a ghost, 1.5 million as a superhero, and 1.4 million as a witch. That does fall in the top five. Now for adults, the top costume is a witch. 5.8 million adults plan to dress like a witch, nearly 2.4 million as a vampire, 1.8 million as Barbie. Can anyone say we're surprised? More than 1.4 million as Batman, and over a million people are dressing up as a cat. Now, those are just store-bought costumes. I'll get to the number one homemade costume later in the show, and I'll bet many of you can already guess what it's going to be. But first, let's talk about some Halloween traditions and where they came from, so we know what it is that we're dealing with. Did you know that jack-o'-lanterns started as an Irish custom, and it was a practice to ward away evil spirits? But over time, this Christian-themed allegory emerged, and there's a story saying that a character named Stingy Jack outsmarts the devil and avoids hell, but his sinful dealings keep his soul out of heaven. So his soul is roaming the earth and lighting his path with an ember and a carved radish, of all things. I think it's safe to say there are some major theology issues there. And I've talked about trick-or-treating, but during the transition to All Souls Day, people would go door-to-door asking for souls cakes in exchange for prayers for the dead. And this was actually encouraged at the time by the church, because before that, people would leave food and wine out for dead spirits. But Scottish influence actually started swapping prayers for tricks and making spooky costumes to prank their neighbors. So one of the staples of American Halloween is scary movies. Now, these scary movies entered American pop culture in the 70s with the Halloween series of movies, and then started a long procession of horror movies and slasher movies. So why am I telling you this? Well, first, I'm telling you these things to say the history of Halloween is just like the answer of whether or not families should participate. It's complicated. But the important takeaway here, and all of those things I just shared with you, is that when we engage in family tradition, we need to do it in an informed way and with intentionality. So as we progress through some more topics here, there are two questions that you should discuss with your family about Halloween. Number one, what are we doing? And number two, why are we doing it? Now, you can flip the paradigm too and say, what are we not doing and why are we not doing it? Now, most of the debate surrounding the celebration of Halloween focuses on this day's unhealthy fascination with evil and with fear. That's just a fact. And there are things about Halloween that are clearly oppositional to our Christian faith. That is true. It would be disingenuous and actually dishonest for me to say that that's not true. Is it inherently evil to let your kids dress up as a princess or a superhero and ask for candy from their neighbors? Not really. So we look at what Scripture has to say about this. In Acts chapter 8, Christians are clearly instructed not to associate with the occult or witchcraft or worshiping other gods. That's a very clear boundary. But in Romans 14, we read this: as for the one who is weak in faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. One person believes he may eat anything, while the weak person eats only vegetables. Let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains. And let not the one who abstains pass judgment on the one who eats, for God has welcomed him. Who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls, and he will be upheld. For the Lord is able to make him stand. One person esteems one day as better than another, while another esteems all days alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. The one who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord. The one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to the Lord, while the one who abstains, abstains in honor of the Lord and give thanks to God. I found a lot of encouragement in this passage, just saying that we have families all over the spectrum, and knowing what our own convictions are is really important. So the first thing that we should do as parents is search our hearts, seek the Lord's wisdom, decide what are our own convictions about today. The second thing we need to do is share those convictions with our family, whether your children are 2 or 20 or even older than that. And foster a nurturing environment where kids have confidence in what they're doing and why they're doing it, and while we respect those who disagree. Now, it's perfectly okay to reset boundaries. So if you've done something in the past, but you have new convictions, gather your kids together and tell them, hey, I have learned some things that have changed the way I feel about us engaging in this activity. I want to share my convictions with you. I want to invite any questions you may have. And I want to make sure we are united moving forward. So you can use these questions as a guide. Is what we are doing honoring to God? And number two, is what we are doing a stumbling block to others? You know, that based on what we talked about, families have struggled with this for centuries. So there is nothing new under the sun in that regard. But when you come back, we'll talk about some safe parameters for trick-or-treating, scary movies, and I'm going to talk about Taylor Swift. Yes, I am. That's going to be the most popular Halloween costume you're going to see this year, so don't miss it. I'll see you on the other side of this break.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Hello, friends, and welcome back. We are talking about Halloween. We're just jumping right in there, and we're talking about family makes a decision about what you're going to do or what you're not going to do is just as important, if not more so, as what decision your family actually makes. And so I'm encouraging you, whatever you're doing or not doing today, to talk with your family about what are we doing and why are we doing it? Because no matter where you stand on Halloween, today is a day that we can shine for Jesus. We can light the night, which is a lot of messages that you'll see Christians using around Halloween. Now, in the first segment, we talked about the history of Halloween and kind of how we got here in this odd mix of culture and religion, and just really got us to this mess that we're in today and this complex day. And for some families, it's not complex. You know, for some families, this can be very easy, but others struggle with it. So let's talk about some of those specific elements. Let's talk about trick-or-treating. Now, you know, I'm a mom of four. I have three teens and one young adult. And so I am always cognizant of those teens on Halloween because teens can do some really scary stuff on Halloween. But I also see a lot of negative talk about teens going trick-or-treating, saying you're too old to do that. And, you know, if you open the door to a teenager being like, what are you doing? You're too old here. And for me, as a mom of teens and as a pediatric nurse practitioner, I think, oh my goodness, do you know what they could be doing? I mean, personally, I'm thrilled that this is the less risky behavior that they're having. So if you do have your teens going, just know that that can be a safe alternative compared to many other popular teen venues, including parties or haunted houses or other destructive and dangerous places like abandoned sheds out in the woods. And so if you're letting your kids go out, especially if you're letting your kids go out by themselves, here's some tips for trick-or-treaters. Know their friends, know who they're going with, not just their name, but you really should know who they are and invest in their friends. Know and agree on the plan beforehand. Know what their costume is and approve it or don't approve it. Agree on a specific route. Agree on a specific time. Agree on specific expectations and review basic safety tips. This is a great way to set your teens up for success, to know exactly what the boundaries are. So if they step outside of those boundaries, they'll also know exactly what the consequences will be. Now, if you are hosting people at your home or in your community or any other event, I encourage you to smile at teens who come to your door and socially engage. Introduce yourself, get to know your teen neighbors, and speak encouraging words to say stay safe and communicate care. You never know what kind of messages that can be. Now, there's a lot of alternatives to Halloween events. You can host a fall-themed party in your home. You can have a movie on the driveway and pass out treats. You could go bowling. You could do pumpkin carving. You can volunteer at a hospital. You can have a family game night or cooking contest. Or you can have a reverse trick-or-treat where you go and actually give treats to your neighbors. Or maybe you do gingerbread houses that are themed for fall. Maybe you have a pumpkin decorating contest or a Bible character family costume contest. I'll tell you, I've seen this before, and the results can be absolutely hilarious trying to guess who is who. Now, one of my favorite things to do is actually to visit nursing homes. So there are a lot of really precious things that kids can dress up as that aren't scary or evil, but to go to an elderly person's home or a nursing home who doesn't get to see kids, to see their face light up and to have that interaction and to have your kids engaging in an act of service is just one of the most heartwarming things that I've ever seen. And also be sensitive to people who may be coming with food allergies. You may have seen the teal pumpkin trend that if you have foods that are allergen safe, you know, that don't have nuts, then you can have a teal pumpkin on your porch. Those are all things to think about for trick-or-treating. Okay, let's talk a little bit about scary movies now, because this is another very popular trend for people to watch scary movies. Not me. Definitely not me. I went to see E.T. when I was in the fourth grade, and they had a preview for Night of the Living Dead, followed by a preview for Gremlins, and then I saw a couple of other scary movies at slumber parties and TV shows, and let's just say I spent a year sleeping in the bathroom with the light on. Like, I would sneak in there. I am not a scary movie kind of girl, but the truth is that the neuroscience of this is really fascinating. So when you watch a horror movie or a scary movie, it actually stimulates your brain in a very specific way, and you respond physically and emotionally with mostly fear. And believe it or not, I still don't understand it, honestly, for some people, it's a lot of fun. Now, let me explain this a little bit. After the initial shock of that scare has sunk into our brains, our higher thinking starts kicking in, and we start experiencing the sensations of what we're hearing, what we're seeing, and our brain is trying to interpret the meaning of what we're seeing. And there's a part in your brain called the temporal lobe. In the temporal lobe, there's a part of your brain called the amygdala. And it is like the control center for your body on how to respond to fear. It affects your brain. It affects your heart. It affects your lungs and your hormones. And it basically hijacks your body for that fight or flight response. So when you're watching a scary movie, your heart and your breathing rate could quicken, because that is your body trying to boost the oxygen supply to your brain and to your heart. So you're ready to run away if you need to. It can also make you have an upset stomach or feel nauseous or even throw up, because that, again, is your body helping you to run away and diverting blood away from your tummy to your heart and your brain and those important things. Also, when you're watching a scary movie, your cortisol and your adrenaline levels rise. And think about, like, basically superheroes, you know, people who are able to do things that are superhuman. It's because of that cortisol and adrenaline. And then, perhaps most fascinating, your mental focus sharpens. Colors are brighter, movements are more visible, you hear things more acutely. And so all your attention is directed to the situation at hand. And you know what happens? You stop worrying about the thing that you were worrying about. You stop thinking or being anxious about whatever you were anxious about before, or whatever you were depressed about before. Because when you're watching a movie, deep down, you know that it's just a movie. And so even though you think it feels like a scary situation, you are enjoying those pleasant effects of the endorphins that now come and the oxygen that's flooding your body to calm yourself down. So that experience of your brain calming itself down after watching a scary movie is actually, that's what people find pleasurable and why they want to watch scary movies. And that's because that dopamine release causes you to feel safer. You know that that's not going to happen to you. Now, on the flip side of that, watching horrific images triggers unwanted thoughts and feelings, and it increases your levels of anxiety or panic, or even increases our sensitivity to being startled. We all know this, somebody who's really jumpy. That would be me. I'm the worst at jump scares. My kids actually don't even like to go to the theater with me because I embarrass them because I will jump like bigger than anybody. But that's me. But it's also important to recognize that younger kids are developmentally wired to have trouble distinguishing real from imaginary. This is a concept called magical thinking, and they don't know that that scary movie is just a movie. And their life and their mind, it is real as real can be. So personally, I am not a fan of horror movies, but you have to really think when you're monitoring your families, is what are we watching and why are we watching it? Is this honoring to the Lord? Those are questions that you have to answer. So I've got some alternatives for you. If you're looking for a family game or a movie night, It's the Great Pumpkin. Charlie Brown is always a good family favorite. Ben-Hur is a great movie full of adventure with a biblical worldview that can be fun for the whole family to watch. There's a movie Luther about Martin Luther. You can stream movies from Sight and Sound Theater in Branson. I think the one they're streaming now is called Noah. Those are great live-action productions with real animals. If you have older kids, To Kill a Mockingbird might be good. If you have younger kids, Meet Me in St. Louis, that's an old musical with Judy Garland, might be a really good choice, or Sergeant York. Those are just some suggestions that I came up with. Now, thinking about safety, let's move on to safety. A lot of parents are really concerned about their kids' safety. One of the questions that I get most often about Halloween safety is about fentanyl and getting drugs in your Halloween candy. So let's have a little talk about fentanyl, and especially rainbow fentanyl. That has been in the news quite a bit lately, especially over the last year. Now, fentanyl is dangerous. It's 50 times more potent than heroin and 100 times more potent than morphine. So just a little tiny bit can be fatal. And in fact, fentanyl was responsible for more than 75% of teen overdose deaths, and more than 80% of those were unintentional. In 2020 alone, teen deaths from overdose on fentanyl doubled from 500 to about 1,000. Now, you might not think that that sounds like a lot, but I'm telling you, even one death, one tragic preventable death of a young person is just more than we can bear as a collective public conscience. And for that, I'm grateful. A lot of people think the cartel is targeting young people on social media, and they ask me if that's true. And of course it's true. The cartel is always wanting to have more people buy drugs, but selling drugs online is not new. Teens can easily connect to dealers or get drugs through friends. And this is how, you may have heard of a popular psychologist, Dr. Laura. Her son tragically died of an overdose in his own bedroom after ordering a pill off of Snapchat, which you can even order with emojis. And so that can be scary. But the more common question on Halloween is, will my teens mistake fentanyl pills for candy? And I have to say, this is really highly unlikely. Most of the time, this rainbow fentanyl still looks like pills. And there are very limited reported cases of pills being packaged as candy. Club drugs have been distributed like this as brightly colored for a long, long time. And I said on the show the other day, and my husband actually told me that it horrified him, that teens will sometimes take those pills from home and put them in a communal bowl and pass them around at parties. I do see this happening on Halloween. So talking to your kids is important. They need to know that overdose can happen. And because fentanyl is so potent, that it can, one pill can kill. That is the FDA's initiative, is that one pill can kill. And there is a medication called Narcan that blocks the effects of fentanyl, but it doesn't really work that well on fentanyl. Another concern, though, is that fentanyl is absorbed through the skin, like if I touch it. And this is actually highly unlikely, though, because fentanyl can be swallowed, it can be snorted, it can be injected, but it is really difficult to absorb it through the skin without moisture. And that's why, I mean, really, if you think about it, pharmaceutical companies invested millions of dollars and years of research to develop a medical-grade patch that does this. So if you're worried about something, or if you encounter something, the best thing to do is to call law enforcement and not touch it. But don't panic if you have touched it. So what should parents do? We have to remember that fear-based tactics don't work. We can't panic, we can't lecture, we can't threaten. We have to concentrate on calmly and confidently coaching our kids to navigate these potential pitfalls. And so telling them, hey, I want to be sure you know you can come to me at any time. You can always ask me anything. And no matter how uncomfortable or scary, I promise we'll get through it together. Remind your teens that taking any medication that's not specifically prescribed for them is dangerous. And that's why we as parents have to really model those practices, not giving our kids medication that belongs to somebody else. Sometimes I've seen that happen at a school. They think they're taking a Tylenol, but it's really maybe a Tylenol number 3. So kids should always just take medication that's prescribed to them. So talking to your kids about this, you know, just making sure that they're safe. And when they're looking at that candy, making sure it's safe, some good practices are, don't eat anything until you get home and you can see everything clearly in the light. So have a snack or dinner or something before you're headed out, so you're not tempted to eat that Halloween candy before you can look at it. And make sure it doesn't look like it's been tampered with, or that there's holes in it or something like that. That can be really, really important for candy safety. But for some other safety tips, you know, actually, as for me, as a healthcare professional, One of the things I worry about the most on Halloween is street safety. We've got a lot of kids who are walking the streets, so making sure that you are using some sort of lighting device if you're out. If you're driving and you're not participating in Halloween, just remembering to put your phone down and don't be distracted driver to make sure that you're looking for kids can be really, really important. Making sure that their costume, they're not going to trip on it, or that if they have something over their face, they can still see to walk. That's really, really important. And it's always a great time to teach your kids about safety when they're walking, making sure that you enter and exit driveways and alleys really slowly and carefully. And parents, if you are out walking with your kids tonight, make a commitment to keep your eyes on your kids and not on your phones. I'll tell you, as I look at the parade of people on my sidewalk or in my neighborhood, a lot of times I will see little kids toddling in front and parents on their phones in the back. Make sure that you are present wherever your kid is, whether you're trick or treating, you're watching a movie, or doing anything like that. The last thing that I'll talk about in this segment is the candy stealing challenge. A lot of you may have seen that viral challenge of stealing your kid's candy and saying, it's not there. Oh gosh, and what happens? And then you videotape your kid crying. Well, I did post about this, and it's similar to the egg crack challenge, and we have to be really thoughtful about how we use our kids and leverage them for our social media. I'll tell you the rest of it on the other side of this break, and we'll talk Taylor Swift. See you in a minute.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. We are just jumping in and exploring all of those complicated decisions that families make about Halloween and talking about, should Christian families participate? And I've shared with you that really what are we doing and why are we doing it are two questions that you should be asking your family. What are we doing tonight? Why are we doing it? Or what are we not doing tonight? And why are we not doing it? It's so important for kids to have a sense of identity around those family traditions and to know what they're doing and to feel like they were a part of that decision making and that they can confidently speak about it to their peers about what they're not doing or doing and feel like they're not alone. Like, this is what my family does. That's really powerful. Now, before the break, I was talking about the viral challenge of stealing your kid's candy and then videotaping their reaction. Now, anytime this happens, you can cue all the keyboard warriors to respective shouting corners. One side says, "This is outrageous child abuse," and the other says, "Hey, get over yourself. We're just having some fun. You need to lighten up." And so a lot of people ask me, is it humorous or is it harmful? Well, let's talk about the risk for harm first. A child's most important relationship is with a trusted caregiver. Now, God designed it to be this way. The way that a bond develops alters their brain chemistry and structure, and it can be healthy or harmful. But there is a very real power dynamic between parent and child that has to be stewarded carefully. So anytime you're thinking about participating in a social media challenge or videoing your child on a prank, you really have to search your heart on your motivation. Why do you really want to do this? Does your child have a temperament that would enjoy this practical joke? Is joking a norm in your relationship, or is this going to be something out of the blue? Now, once you think about why you want to do it, then you have to ask yourself, why do I want to video this? Is it to preserve a funny family memory? Are you laughing with your child or at your child? That's an important distinction. And then when you think about why you've wanted to video it, you should think about, why do you want to post it? Is it more about you or is it about your kid? Oh, that steps on some toes, I know. But here's some truth. It's never okay to hurt or embarrass your child and then shame them for not being able to take a joke. That's gaslighting. And children have very limited privacy rights on the internet, so we're stewarding their digital footprint. So will this prank age well? When we are living at the speed of a smartphone, we have to pause and think before posting. And so that is what I have to say about that. Now, I promised you that I was going to be talking about Taylor Swift, and I know some of you already are reaching to change the radio station thinking, I hear this all over everywhere. But listen, if we want to influence our kids' worldview, we have to start by viewing the world as they see it and meeting them where they are. Now, you may be a parent or a grandparent who just does not understand at all this obsession with Taylor Swift and how everything, and now she's taken over the NFL because she's dating an NFL player. And it's so humorous to see all of the people who never knew anything about football asking questions about football, although they're not really asking questions about football, are they? They're saying, wait, Travis has a brother in the NFL, so he plays too? And I know that that has been much to the chagrin of many men across this country. But if you know a kid who really admires Taylor Swift, or if you don't, if say your kid doesn't know. Now, I was that mom when my kids were growing up. My girls did not listen to Miley Cyrus in those days. And I remember one day one of them coming home from school and talking about Miley Cyrus, and I was kind of curious as to her perception. And she finally said, yeah, I think that's one of the girls' grandmothers or something. They talk about her all the time. But listen, I'm going to give you Taylor Swift in a nutshell so that you can be positioned as an expert and be able to insert yourself into young people's conversation and have some influence there. So Taylor Swift, in case you didn't know, she really does have a lot of accomplishments. And I'm going to give this, I'm going to go back to Mama Bear apologetics in just a minute. So hang with me as I give you some facts. She signed her first record deal at the age of 14 years old. Then she released her first album at 16, and she got her first country music television award at 17. And the year after that, she released the album Fearless, and it became the longest Billboard chart topper by a female country artist. In 2009, she became the youngest person to ever win the CMA Entertainer of the Year. And then she won the Best Female Vocalist for the VMAs. So this is when she's winning Female Vocalist of the Year. And the rapper, Kanye West, comes on stage to say, basically, you didn't deserve this, Beyonce deserved this. So hang with me here a minute and let me explain to you something, because this is really where Swifties took off. That's what Taylor Swift fans call themselves. And they listen to something called Taylor's version. So if you're wondering what that is, it started here. Hang with me and let me explain it to you. Swifties, again, that's what Taylor Swift fans call themselves. They listen to the Taylor's version. So after Kanye came on and criticized her, her career really exploded. She had 6 albums that she recorded. And when Kanye had came up and made disparaging remarks about her, he followed it up in a song and it was explicit. And he went on to record a video with a mannequin that looked like Taylor, and the Swifties got angry. And at the time, Kim Kardashian, who was Kanye's wife, she released a recording of a phone call that made it seem like Taylor gave permission to use these bad words and disparaging remarks about her. Now, also at this time, Taylor got a lot of criticism for dating too much and writing songs about her exes. So in her own words, she decides, I'm not going to date. I'm just going to focus on my friendships. And then what does the media do? They question her dating preferences and her gender identity. And I think this kind of sparked a rebellion in her, because her next album was Reputation, and she talked about the impact on her reputation. So all during this time, this guy named Scooter Braun is Kanye's manager at the time, but he goes and buys Taylor's record label and owned all of her songs. So long and complicated story short that I'm sure Swifties out there are going to say, I got some of the details wrong and I apologize. She didn't own the master recordings of those first 6 albums. So she has been re-recording them and releasing them. And there you have it. That is called Taylor's Version. So they are really seeing the power of their fan base. Now, why is this so appealing? Well, it's because of identity. They have an identity and a clique that somehow everyone is welcome into. That is really the message that's being sold. And when you look at this young woman who's had remarkable success, that's someone that they want to emulate. So even from there, she was the first woman in 2016 to ever get 2 Grammys for Album of the Year. And then in 2021, she did it 3 times. Now, the only people to ever get 3 Grammys before were Stevie Wonder, Frank Sinatra, and Paul Simon. You probably followed the news this year that she broke Ticketmaster with unprecedented demand. But the truth is that she sold 114 million albums. Now, Elvis the King, of course, tops that by 233 million, and he is only topped by the Beatles at 292 million. But Taylor is in her mid-30s, and just this week, it was announced that she is a billionaire. Now, she credits her fans, her Swifties, for this, and they have that identity. So now we've got the Eras Tour that is, you know, sweeping the country and now sweeping the world. It's over 3 hours long, and it's basically 44 songs in 10 acts. She's had 146 shows in 19 states with an average of more than 72,000 people at every show. Now, if you're starting to think, oh my gosh, she sounds like a Swiftie, let me quickly pivot here and tell you, go back, like I told you, we had Hillary Morgan Ferrer on before, and she talked about apologetics, and I'm going to give you an application of apologetics in initiating conversation with your kids about Taylor Swift. Now, she uses this acronym, Roar Like a Mother, so we're going to go through that. R is for recognize the message. Now, the message here is friendship. If you look, you will see a lot of friendship bracelets if you are out and about and you see Halloween costumes tonight. That will be the thing because Taylor Swift's main platform is message, is friendship. Now, I will tell you, I went and screened this movie because I feel like it's part of my job to know what kids are seeing. And I am not a young woman anymore, and it is a long movie, and I did need to go to the restroom during the movie, and I was worried because I was in the middle thinking, oh, I'm going to have to go past all of these people. Well, let me tell you, as I walked past the girls that were sitting in the seats, they each handed me a friendship bracelet and just said, oh, that's okay. I've never had people be nicer to me about going to the bathroom in a movie. I know, we need to move on from that, but that is what it is. So the O, if we're in Roar Like a Mother, we have recognize the message. The O is offer discernment. Now, part of offering discernment is affirming the good and rejecting the bad. We have to affirm the good things to maintain our credibility, but our kids have to reject the bad things to maintain their credibility. So good things are that she really loves her parents. She loves her brother. She's very goofy and silly and approachable, and she's very girl next door. And she does have some good songs. I challenge any parent out there to listen to The Best Day or Never Grow Up with a Dry Eye. And that is a really common song that's played at weddings. Now, compared to her contemporaries like Cardi B and Beyonce, she is tame. And she records separate clean versions of her albums. So if you go on to her website, you can get clean versions. Now, what's the flip side of that? The bad is that she needs clean versions. And the language in the Eras Tour is not insubstantial. There are 4 F words. I'm just going to put it out there because there usually are just 2 in a PG-13 movie. And there's something jarring about this girl next door who is all of a sudden singing with these words coming out of her mouth and very little tiny girls in the theater emulating that. And just in my humble opinion, it's very off-brand. And there's a lot of other language in that. There is some sexual content. It is suggestive, but not explicit. There are some alcohol references. And in one album, there is some perception and criticism of appearances of witchcraft or the occult, because these figures that appear to be kind of robed druids, as they've been referred to, they carry orbs, and it looks like Taylor is casting a spell. And most significantly, she does advocate for social and political issues that are clearly contrary to a biblical worldview. So that's the O. The A is argue for a healthier approach, and then reinforce through discussion, discipleship, and prayer. So in arguing for a healthier approach, I took these questions off of PluggedIn.com, which is a great media guide that helps to know what is out there and how do you talk to your kids about it. So these are questions that you can ask and initiate conversation if you are talking about Taylor Swift. What do you think makes Taylor's songs so appealing? What songs or messages do you connect with personally? What do you think Taylor has to say about romance and identity in her songs? Taylor Swift is one of the most powerful, influential, and richest women in the world, yet many of her songs are, at some level, responding to how others view her. What do you think about that? How much should we let others' opinions of us impact our own sense of identity of who we are? It's obvious that that's a question Taylor has wrestled with a lot. How does Taylor's conception of love and intimacy compare to what Scripture has to say about genuine love, as well as the purpose and place of physical and intimate expression in our relationships? These are all questions, and I'll tell you that Gen Z really does want to engage in meaningful conversation. So don't be afraid to initiate conversation rather than having an argument about you're going to listen to this or you're not going to listen to this. I encourage you to think about intentionally initiating conversation. In my book, Behind Closed Doors, a guide to help parents and teens navigate through life's toughest issues, I talk a lot about the science of music and how it impacts our heart. And if you haven't looked at your kids' playlists lately, I would encourage you to do that and read the lyrics of what is competing with you for the heart and the mind of your child. That's really important. Now, I do have a hope-themed playlist that you can find on my Spotify profile. I'll post that on my social media. Fair warning to some of you, there is a lot of Christmas music on there, but if you are the kind of person who doesn't listen to Christmas music until after Thanksgiving, it's okay, because I'm the kind of person who will just pray for your tiny little shriveled Grinch heart. No, I'm kidding. But we are going to talk about something Christmas. I want to remind you about Operation Christmas Child, how we can send the good news of Jesus Christ to children around the world. And that may be a great project for you to have tonight. You can go to SamaritansPurse.org/OCC to learn more and to find a drop-off location near you. So maybe if you haven't decided what you're going to do tonight, this would be a great family activity to pack a box together and to make an impact on a child somewhere around the world. Any standard shoebox will do. You can either participate through your church or you can go online and find out how to do it yourself. Stephanie and I did ours yesterday, and we'll be sharing those and dropping those off at our church tomorrow. Well, I'll see you tomorrow on the Dr. Nurse Mama Show. We've got a great show planned for you. See you there.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.